Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Trump's campaign-style rally in Arizona last night, where, along with blaming the press for trying to take away our history and our heritage, he accused the media of giving a platform to these hate groups as the president whipped up the crowd with chants of CNN sucks. Trump also threatened to shut down the government if he did not get money for his border wall and indicated he would pardon former Sheriff Joe Arpaio in the near future. Joining us is Rick Wilson, a national Republican political strategist and media consultant who has been a vocal critic of Donald Trump. But after last night's performance, he has concluded that Trump is, quote, a man who obviously is mentally unstable. This is a man who is not qualified or mentally or morally fit to be president of the United States. And tonight was one more proof of it. But if people around him don't think this guy is bat crap crazy, they are mistaken. We will discuss the growing awareness among the public and the political class that Donald Trump's erratic outbursts and contradictory behavior of professing love and healing while spreading hate and division is raising the question of the 25th Amendment coming into play to remove a president on, among other things, psychiatric grounds. Then we'll speak with Dr. Lance Dodes, a former clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and a contributor to the forthcoming book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Professionals Assess a President. He joins us to discuss why the American Psychiatric Association is wrong in hiding behind the Goldwater Rule and not speaking out about the obvious danger of having a president who is delusional and a sociopath. He argues their concerns about diagnosis are unimportant when you consider the fact that Donald Trump has access to the nuclear codes and has the ability to destroy the world as we know it. Then finally, we'll get an update on Pakistani reaction to President Trump's Afghanistan speech and his criticism of Pakistan from Shuja Nawaz, the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council, where he has an article, Trump Misses an Opportunity in Afghanistan, and joins us to discuss the absence of a regional approach to extricating the U.S. from its longest war, and offers the example of how Gorbachev got the Soviet Union out of its quagmire in Afghanistan. And joining us now is Rick Wilson, a national Republican political strategist and media consultant based in Florida, who has produced television for governors, U.S. Senate candidates, super PACs, and corporations, and was a strategist for the recent presidential campaign of Evan McMullen. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rick Wilson.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And last night, following Donald Trump's extraordinary performance in Arizona, you were on CNN, where you described Trump's rally as it was an astounding chain of lies tied together by lunatic asides by a man who obviously is mentally unstable. I mean, I'm not joking about it or being a smartass. This is a man who is not well. This is a man who is not qualified or mentally or morally fit to be the president of the United States. And tonight was one more proof of it. A lot of people have shared that for some time, myself included, that opinion of our president. But do you think the ground is shifting now in terms of a kind of, in the zeitgeist, people are coming to this conclusion?
Well, I think even people who for a long time were giving Donald Trump every possible benefit of the doubt have finally started to observe the behavior over time. And you know, it's not, it doesn't put too fine a point on the question to say that you can't watch this man speak and behave and for lack of a better word, govern to whatever degree he governs. And not wonder about his distracted and discursive nature when he's talking about anything. He has no ability to focus on an issue or a problem. He has no ability to govern himself. His impulses seem to be the predominant driver for all of his behavior. And so I think we're in a situation now where Donald Trump is proving the case that he is not a person who has the mental and moral fitness to do this job. I mean, I stand by what I said on that in that regard, because the proof is out there in our faces every single day.
And you went on to say, I know the 25th Amendment is a remote possibility, but if people around him don't think this guy is absolutely bat-crap crazy, they are mistaken. Now, we take some comfort in the idea that there are some adults on the room, although we're not entirely sure whether they are actually in the room, but the idea that Generals Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly somehow can constrain him or contain him gives some people comfort. Does it give you comfort?
It gives me only a limited amount of comfort. I have a great regard for the three gentlemen you mentioned, because I've been around the defense world for a long time before I was in politics, and I think very highly of Jim Mattis. I think very highly of McMaster, and I think very highly of General Kelly. But I do think that all of these guys recognize they have only so much control over Donald Trump at any given interval, and he resists having anyone tell him you can't do X. And he pushes back against the boundaries of what he should do, not only politically, but morally and as the leader of the free world. So all these things that the military leaders around Trump are trying to make him conform his behavior on will always get a lot of pushback from this president in terms of you know, you made me do X, now I'm going to go out and have fun and do Y, even if Y is something that is problematic, you know, for him as president and for the country at large.
Well, isn't the problem, though, that so many of these adults in the room have to disabuse Donald Trump of the crazy ideas that he had that have been inculcated by Fox and Friends, Breitbart, and also by Alex Jones?
Well, absolutely. The president is not a person. I mean, he's famously not a reader. He is famously a consumer of media, primarily television. And so he has an interesting and shallow picture of the world, and he operates from a bunch of economic and social and political predicates that really haven't been relevant in this country for, you know, 30, 40 years. And I think those things span a lot of different areas, including race and economics and trade policy and a whole host of regions where Donald Trump says and does things that maybe his base think those are great ideas, but economists and scholars and business leaders all look at them and say, not so much.
Well, the surreal nature is that, and I frankly don't understand this without venturing into amateur psychiatrics, but this is the sort of hater-in-chief. This is a man who's out of the gate insulted Latinos in announcing his presidential run, and has done consistently insulted all kinds of people, in really his own people. And now he's apparently having a bitter feud with Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader of the Senate. So it doesn't sort of make sense that you're the hater-in-chief, but yet you have this craving to be loved. And today he's totally switched gears after last night's display, and before the veterans said, you know, called for peace, love, and puka shells, as though he were somebody from the 60s. Go
well,
figure.
He is a mercurial character. There's no doubt about that. And you can always rely on the fact that Donald Trump's, you know, sort of the mercurial and the volatile nature of his emotions and the impulsive nature of his behavior will out. And so, you know, last night he spends much more time bashing Republicans in the U.S. Senate than he does talking about ISIS, the Taliban, or Al Qaeda, or North Korea. But those things that offend his ego at any given moment are what's going to capture his attention. Those things that bother him as a man who is hyper conscious of his media status and of his image in the press. Those things will always get more attention from him. I mean, he has spoken in the course of his presidency, I would venture to say, 10 times more about how much he hates the media than about how much he doesn't like the Taliban or ISIS or North Korea or, and God forbid, say anything hostile or confrontational about Russia. And this is a guy who very much is susceptible to the most, you know, puerile and juvenile kind of blandishments to his ego, and hypersensitive to any kind of slight or any kind of challenge.
And again, I'm speaking with Rick Wilson, a national Republican political strategist and media consultant based in Florida, who has produced television for governors, U.S. Senate candidates, super PACs, and corporations, and was a strategist for the recent presidential campaign of Evan McMullen. Now, you did actually, I keep quoting you from last night, but you said he alternated between being a whiny six-year-old who had his Nintendo taken away and between being a cranky old man who's being out there condemning everyone who doesn't worship him adequately. And again, that is the paradox here of the hater who wants to be loved.
Mm-hmm.
But there seems to me to be a danger, though, in venturing into the psychiatric world in terms of diagnosis. And there was, of course, the Goldwater Rule instituted for that reason, that psychiatrists couldn't comment on or diagnose a politician without actually having personally treated him. Is there a danger in venturing into that field, if you will, in the sense that perhaps the real diagnosis of Donald Trump is that he's not a nice person? He's a hateful, horrible man who has treated people shabbily. He's treated his own people, as we've seen, the way he fires people and discards them like a used Kleenex.
Sure.
But he's also ripped off people, ripped off, you know, small businessmen, contractors, workers, you name it. That's his track record.
Sure. Well, yeah, I think there's one thing to remember. The Venn diagram of being a terrible human being somebody who is exploitative and dishonorable and who doesn't keep a promise to anyone, whether it's a business partner or a marriage partner or anyone else, and being crazy, that Venn diagram can overlap. And I think there's a certain amount of Donald Trump has lived this very entitled life where he has gotten away with things that would have absolutely sent anyone else, any of the rest of us into, you know, Siberia politically or socially for the rest of our lives. He's gotten away with those things his whole life. But I also think that he displays a lot of behavior, the impulsiveness, the narcissism, the constant need for reinforcement and love and attention. I think all those things, you know, I'm not a professional psychiatric analyst of any kind, but I can say this. As my grandmother used to say, from North Florida, you know crazy when you see it. Don't date it. And, you know, he is the kind of person who, you know, he has that superficial charm of the narcissist, where as long as he's maneuvering you into a position where he thinks you're going to praise him and adore him, he's the most charming human being on earth. The moment that charm has won you over, you're nothing. It's over. I mean, you're out of the picture as somebody he's going to pay that kind of attention to. And so I think that we've got a president right now who's very much moved from the phase where he's seducing people to the place where he's abusing people. And this is not something that people who've seen abusive relationships and seen people with mental illness, it's not something that they miss. It's not something that they go, oh, this is strange and unusual. None of it's strange. It's all very evident and all very front of mind.
Well, the reason I brought it up, Rick Wilson, is that mentally ill people, generally quite decent and well-meaning, they just have a problem, you know, and we should be compassionate towards them and not brand them.
I couldn't agree more. Yeah. And I think that's one of the great difficulties with dealing with Donald Trump is you know, loosely using the word crazy with a person with mental illness is not a particularly kind or productive thing to say. But with a man who has the enormous powers of the presidency and who also simultaneously demonstrates all these behaviors with no accountability, I think a lot of Americans, the dual realizations of that he's crazy and that he's got a terrible mean streak and is doing things that's tearing the country apart. You know, eventually you have to use the word that people know and understand and is top of mind. And that sometimes is crazy.
Well, you mentioned how he goes off on the press, and he did last night. But I think he took it further last night than I've actually heard him before. He accused the press of being patriotic, that they don't love America. And that I find really troubling. Things have divided enough with his supporters being immune to facts and evidence and supporting him unconditionally and being unable to be reached, I guess, and the way that he's very cleverly branded the rest of the media as fake news is really a scary division. And I don't know whether he learned from Putin or not, where in Russia, Putin was advised, they call them political technologists over there.
Right.
And he was influenced by this theater director, Surkov, who encouraged Putin to have this condition where nothing is real, nothing is true, but everything is possible. So where truth is a moving target. And I suspect that Trump, in all of his clandestine dealings with the Russians, which eventually hopefully we'll find out the full extent of them, has learned something from that. Is this, are we in danger when you look at Fox and Breitbart and now Sinclair and these other media outlets essentially being the Ministry of Truth in the Orwellian sense, or at the very least, the Pravda of the Republican Party? Have you ever seen a state-run media in America? Isn't that by definition almost un-American?
It is by definition something that our First Amendment would never encompass. And in fact, Americans have a very long tradition of having a vibrant press that was unconstrained as by government regulation under the First Amendment, and by the kind of things that you see coming out of this very lockstep sector of the media right now. I mean, and they don't fall in the technical category of state-run because the government doesn't run them itself, but they are state-centric, they are Trump-centric, and it's a very new territory. We've never had media as partisan towards a single individual as we have with Trump. We had media that was very much in favor of a party before, or very much in favor of an ideological movement before, but never in the same way that this press is worshipful and abjectly focused only on Donald Trump.
So what's in it for Murdoch and company? Is it all tactics and no strategy? Because at the end of the day, I don't think that Murdoch's going to come out well in this situation.
And I think Trump has probably already cost Murdoch the greatest thing he wanted in his career, which was Sky News. And I think that he's got a very, and I think the sons, I think the Murdoch sons have a very different opinion of where Fox's role should be in the spectrum of American political life than their father did. So it's going to be a very interesting challenge ahead with them. And I think they're going to have, I mean, and I think the role of these particular organizations, if Donald Trump collapses, they've made a very, very big bet on a very, very unstable person. And so it's going to be it's going to be an interesting moment if those things go forward.
Well, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Well, Ian, thank you so much for having me on today.
And again, I've been speaking with Rick Wilson, who is a national Republican political strategist and media consultant based in Florida, who has produced television for governors, U.S. Senate candidates, super PACs, and corporations, and was a strategist for the recent presidential campaign of Evan McMullen. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with a prominent psychiatrist who feels the American Psychological Association is wrong in hiding behind the Goldwater Room and not speaking out about the obvious danger of having a president who is delusional and a sociopath.
I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head. I hope he's right in the head, even if he had to wrong someone, yeah.
Come on now, who do you, who do you, who do you, who do you think you are? Bless your soul. Think you're in control? Well, I think you're crazy. I think you're crazy. I think you're crazy.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dr. Lance Dodis, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute, and he was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, a 7-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction and the Sober Truth. And his forthcoming book, of which he is a part, is The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Lance Dodis.
Thank you.
And we were just speaking with Rick Wilson, a Republican strategist who was on CNN last night, where he and most of the other pundits on the panel were responding to Donald Trump's rally in Arizona. And Rick Wilson said Donald Trump alternated between being a whiny six-year-old who's had his Nintendo taken away and between being a cranky old man who's being out there condemning everyone who doesn't worship him adequately. That does seem to be a paradox, maybe to me, not to you. Why is somebody who spews so much hatred want to be loved?
Oh, well, I think that those actually do go together. I see what you mean, but because he is so, he appears to have so much need to be admired, to be bolstered all the time, he then reacts to anyone who is not an acolyte, who doesn't fawn upon him, who doesn't play up to him. He hates those people. It's more or less either or. And we've seen this time and again when, although he demands loyalty from people around him, he has no loyalty to them. You know, as soon as they disappoint him or they seem to turn against him or even disagree with him, they're out. And that characterizes a certain kind of serious personality problem that he has. You know, it's one thing to say he acts like a six-year-old or he's a con man and so forth. All these things are so, but diagnostically, he has a very severe emotional problem, which we know about. It's not new. It's the same kind of emotional problem that many tyrants have had throughout history and many criminals have had. It's often called being a psychopath or a sociopath is the modern term. So sociopathy is exactly this. It's bad behavior, it's cheating, lying, it's a failure to have empathy for others or to really care about others, to have a focus only on yourself, and a willingness to harm others for your own ends. That describes most of Donald Trump's life and certainly all of his recent life. That is actually a mental incapacity. Normal people don't do that. It's not just that you're being bad or being, as somebody said, crazy like a fox. It's nothing like that. It's not just being manipulative. It's an inability. And we know it's an inability because Trump actually has done and said things that are not in his interest, but he can't keep himself from doing it. Even this latest rally in Phoenix, it's not in his interest to create more hostility toward himself, to appear like a fool, which he does all the time. I mean, a rational person, if he were just the manipulator, you know, perhaps if he were just a Richard Nixon, you know, he would know that politically he's harming himself. But Trump is out of control. And he loses track of, it's one aspect of losing track of reality. You know, we know he says things that simply aren't true. He doesn't seem to be aware of that. He doesn't seem to be aware. So that's the definition of a delusion. He says things that aren't so, and when it's pointed out, it doesn't matter. He believes them. So this is a very, very sick man. And the people who have said, you know, don't confuse, he's just being bad, he's not sick, don't understand that sociopathy is exactly this, and it's a very severe problem. Normal people have empathy. He does not.
So in other words, you're not insulting mentally ill people who, by and large, decent people who have a real problem. In other words, some people have suggested that, well, you know, don't insult the mentally ill. This guy's just a bad person.
Yeah, no, yes, that's a ridiculous, I know it's been made, it is a completely ridiculous, baseless argument. None of us in the field would ever insult anyone with mental illness. Our whole careers are based on trying to help people who have emotional problems. This has nothing to do with that. And truthfully, I think most of the public understands that. No one is confusing a person who is depressed or who is anxious or a person who has schizophrenia or bipolar disorder or major mental illness. No one is confusing that with Donald Trump. I mean, if you want to confuse him with somebody, you'd have to confuse him with other psychopaths, with other sociopaths. You know, as I said, the famous ones are the famous tyrants of history who have done what he does. They gather people around them who are loyal to them. They don't care who they hurt or even kill. They have no empathy, and they will cheat and lie to get where they want to go. That's not normal. It's not just bad behavior. It's a basic defect in what it means to be human.
So is that to say, then, that we should be grateful that Donald Trump is not a more effective tyrant? That
yes.
His mental illness actually is an impediment to him being even more autocratic and totalitarian even?
Yes, I think that's actually, that's right. That is right. And of course, the fear is that if the country has been able to be conned into voting for Trump, they might be conned again by someone who does it, but in a more clever way. You know, we must never forget that Adolf Hitler was elected. He wasn't, you know, he didn't rise to power through a coup. He was actually elected by the German people, who had no clue what they were getting into, and he ran on the same same platform as Trump. He's, you know, he took a nation that was devastated after a war, a lot of people out of work, humiliated, and he basically said, make Germany great again. Just what Trump, Donald Trump said. So, you know, we've seen this lots of times, and it's important for the public to understand this is not about mental health in general. It has nothing to do with that. And it certainly, as far as the ban on talking about this, that is also extremely unethical. The so-called ethical Goldwater rule is unethical itself because it makes no sense. I can talk more about that if you'd like.
Well, indeed, I'd like to do that. And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Lance Dodis, a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytical Society and Institute. He was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, A Seven-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction, and The Sober Truth. And he's a contributor to the forthcoming book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President. Let's talk about the Goldwater Rule, which was brought about by the American Psychiatric Association following the 1964 campaign of Barry Goldwater, where he was trounced by Lyndon Johnson. And the idea was that subsequent to that, no psychiatrist can diagnose a politician unless they've actually personally treated them. Is that an accurate summary?
Yeah, that is an accurate summary. The problem is, there are several problems. For one thing, the kind of diagnosis that they were talking about back in the 70s when the Goldwater Rule originated has nothing to do with what we're talking about. They were talking about psychiatrists who were making assumptions about the inner traumatic, specific, conflictual life of people. For example, this is kind of a silly example, but let's say somebody said, well, Donald Trump is the way he is because he had difficult toilet training. That's the sort of nonsensical thing that would be wrong to say. But what we're talking about has nothing to do with that. We're talking about observing behavior and speech. And in fact, the American Psychiatric Association itself, in its own manual, diagnoses people exactly that way. If you look at that manual, you will see that each diagnostic label is a list of behaviors and speech, which anyone can see. So it's nothing to do with that. And when the head of the APA said we shouldn't, to use her term, we shouldn't psychoanalyze him, she doesn't understand what psychoanalysis is. No one is psychoanalyzing him. We're observing his overt behavior and speech, which are clear. Now, the question about whether it's unethical is also it's self-serving for the American Psychiatric Association, and that's all. Certainly isn't helping anybody else. It's not helping Donald Trump. It's not protecting him, I mean. We've all noticed who he is already. But if you ask them, the American Psychiatric Association says that they want to protect themselves, and this is what they said, from a bad image. It makes psychiatry or psychiatrists look bad, they said, if we do this. That's no reason not to speak. That's actually a terrible reason not to speak. The other thing is, psychiatry is a branch of medicine, and medical ethics have nothing to do with speaking about public figures, nothing. Medical ethics has everything to do with how you treat patients, and that's why there are rules about confidentiality, and that's the idea of you don't talk about something without the permission of the patient. That's true. But Donald Trump is not our patient. He's a public figure. There is no medical ethical issue with him. There's only the issue that people want to protect their name. And the other point about, you know, it being a stigma about mental illness, as I said before, that makes absolutely no sense at all. So I think those are the main problems with, I mean, the Goldwater Rule is itself unethical because it tries to gag people at a time the nation could use some expert advice. Oh, and by the way, of course, no other medical field has this rule. If you see someone injured in a sports match, the next thing is you hear an orthopedist in another part of the country talking about the, you know, how he probably has an ACL injury in his knee and what the proper procedure is for treating it or what the prognosis is. Every medical specialty speaks about public incidents and public figures. Psychiatry doesn't want to do it for their own reasons and their own protection.
Well, it feels as though we're fiddling while Rome is burning, you know, nitpicking over the Goldwater Rule, when we should be talking about whether or not the man who has his finger on the nuclear codes, who can literally destroy the planet, is sober, stable enough. And of course, the word stability came up with Senator Corker, fellow Republican, who questioned Trump's stability very recently. That, to me, transcends everything here. And what troubles me about Donald Trump is he's already exhibited some strange obsessions, if you will, with nuclear weapons. The most recent, of course, and this is where it gets very cynical, it was the Trump administration that leaked the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency report, on that North Korea had miniaturized their nuclear warheads. And that they leaked it to the Washington Post so that Trump could make a big issue, literally gin up a crisis with North Korea, where his rhetoric became just as nutty as the rhetoric that we expect from the North Koreans. And he was literally playing with nuclear fire in order to distract the public from maybe the Russian investigation, whatever. And now, of course, that situation has been somewhat cooled down, but still, it was pretty reckless on his part and very cynical. But I heard from some State Department briefers who briefed him very early. When this is the routine, when you become president-elect, you get a briefing by the State Department where they do a kind of round robin and they tell you about everything that's going on in the world, you know, give you a sort of orientation. And apparently in this first meeting, President-elect Trump in Trump Tower, all he wanted to talk about was what would happen if a nuclear weapon hit New York. And the briefers got very, very uncomfortable and quite disturbed by Trump. So I know I'm throwing out a bunch of anecdotal stuff here, but it gets to the heart of what I think is the real issue here. Is this man who you are questioning his mental health and other people are doing this and you're a professional, is he a suitable steward for the nuclear buttons which at any moment could destroy the world?
Not only is he not a suitable steward, but if you think about it, he is maybe one of the very worst people you would ever want to have in that position in the entire country. I can easily think of tens of millions of kinds of people in the United States who would be better at that because they're not so deeply disturbed. Most people aren't, you know. And this goes to the other issue about, you know, stigmatizing people with mental health issues. I don't mind if people have mental health issues. My goodness, they're, as you said, who doesn't really, you know? Lincoln was seriously depressed. He was a great president. But this kind of issue, this kind of sociopathic, severe character disorder makes him one of the worst people you could possibly have in charge, plus the fact that he's out of touch with reality much of the time. So I completely agree with you. That is the bottom line here. He is completely unfit and horribly dangerous, and he should have been gotten out of office earlier, and I hope he will be gotten out of office soon through the 25th Amendment, if not impeachment. You know, that's a political issue. Obviously, the people who are supporting him are, I'm sure, weighing their own political futures about staying with him versus doing the right thing. I did want to say one more thing about the Goldwater Rule, which I forgot to say. That is, only the American Psychiatric Association has that rule. The American Psychological Association is different. The National Association of Social Workers is different. The American Psychoanalytic Association is different, and that actually came out recently as a news item. Nobody has the rule they do. Everyone else says, well, be circumspect, be careful talking about public figures, and everyone agrees with that. No one wants to have a Soviet-style system where, you know, if you don't like somebody, you put them in a psychiatric hospital. This has nothing to do with that, and it has nothing to do with politics. It has only to do with a national emergency with somebody who is a dangerous figure on a psychological basis, and it's simply unethical to not speak about it.
Well, there is some movement in regard to invoking the 25th Amendment. Representative Jackie Speier, the Democrat of California, has called for Trump to be removed from office using the 25th Amendment. And
yes.
Representative Zoe Lofgren, also of California, introduced a resolution calling on Trump to undergo a mental health exam. Of course, they're Democrats and California Democrats, which I guess disqualifies them in the eyes of the Republicans and certainly in the eyes of Donald Trump. But is there any indication anywhere that the Republicans, I mentioned Senator Bob Corker suggesting that Trump lacks the stability and competence to be president. That was pretty, I think, strong stuff. Any hints?
Well,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and if you go back to the campaign, there were a number of prominent Republicans who said that they would never vote for Donald Trump because he was a danger, including the general who was, what is his name, who was...
Colin Powell, you mean? Colin Powell.
Yeah, Colin Powell. Yeah, and a number of other very prominent, intelligent, thoughtful Republicans said that they would never support him. Look, at this point, it's, as I said, it's pretty clear that the Republicans are weighing their personal futures. My guess is that most of them are probably decent people who know that Trump is unfit and dangerous, but he was elected by their constituency, and so they're afraid. They're afraid to do the right thing because they're afraid they'll get tossed out of office. You know, it will require a change in public perception so that their personal political futures are not in doubt, and then they can go ahead and do the right thing. But, you know, there's not a lot of moral courage there so far.
Well, but surely it has to be done right and has to be done in a convincing way because he's got 35% of Americans absolutely living in Trump land where they are they're immune to facts and evidence. And he's got them convinced that the evidence that the fake news or that the mainstream media put out is fake news. So he's completely got them siloed. And they also, you know, represent the far right in this country, which is heavily armed and quite dangerous. So what could break that spell, do you think, that he has over his... Because that's why these Republicans are behaving in such a craven and disgusting way, is because they're worried about getting primaried by these crazies.
Well, there's that, but there... Yeah, I understand that. You know, there comes a time where you have to just do what's right. I don't know how else to say it. And one of the things that I think has a kind of big lie that's been propagated by Trump supporters is that opposition to Trump is political. You just mentioned that these people are Democrats, so you can't trust them. That's completely wrong. And again, I would use the analogy to Germany. If you were in Germany in 1932, would you say that opposition to Hitler was political? Because you were supporting the Weimar Republic or another party, not the Nazi Party. At some point, it stops being political. It starts being doing the right thing for humanity and for decency and to combat racism and anti-Semitism and other bigotry. At some point, you just have to do the right thing. The Republicans haven't gotten to that point yet, but we all have to hope they will. And I think that events like Charlottesville may push the public to enough outrage so that there will be the politicians will decide it's in their interest to finally stand up against Trump. I hope that day is coming soon, because the other thing that's very likely, you mentioned the North Korean crisis, the other thing that's very likely is that Trump will create, as he already has done, create a national crisis which is a traditional technique of tyrants to rally people around them. You know, it's been true throughout history. In America, in the turn of the last century, it was the blowing up of the battleship Maine in Havana Harbor created an excuse to have a war with Spain. In this century, Hitler set fire to the Reichstag, to the Parliament building, so he could have an excuse to consolidate his power. I think that Trump is extremely likely to do that. That actually is, I mean, he's always likely to press the nuclear button, but he is, I think, even perhaps at least as likely to create a major crisis like with North Korea, and then the country rallies around a president in wartime. And that would be very good for him, for himself personally, which is all he really cares about. But it would be a disaster because it would turn people away from noticing who he is.
Well, I see this situation, just in closing, being paradoxically the kind of the opposite of that movie that John Frankenheimer made in the 60s during the Cold War, 7 days in May, which was about a military takeover of the United States, a military coup by a bunch of right-wing generals who thought the president was too soft on communist Soviet Union. We actually have a similar but inverted situation from that. We have a bunch of general officers, Mattis, McMaster, and Kelly. They're in there, presumably between Donald Trump and the nuclear button, at least we hope they are. And at some point or other, are we going to have a military coup to stop a madman from creating either a nuclear war or a wag the dog war in order to boost his ratings?
Yes, right. Well, that's right. I agree. I think that's a serious risk. And the antidote to that, if there is one, is predicting it. Everyone will know when it starts to happen again, when he starts to ratchet things up with Iran or with North Korea or with Russia or somebody, the next time he tries to create an international crisis in which he hopes that we will all turn to Trump, we'll know what he's doing. We won't be fooled by it.
Well, Dr. Lance Dodis, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Lance Dodis, who's a training and supervising analyst emeritus with the Boston Psychoanalytic Society and Institute. He was a clinical professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School and is the author of The Heart of Addiction, Breaking Addiction, A Seven-Step Handbook for Ending Any Addiction, and The Sober Truth. And he's a contributor to the forthcoming book, The Dangerous Case of Donald Trump, 27 Psychiatrists and Mental Health Experts Assess a President.
چشمان مست سیاحت مبند نازنی نازداری به موی کمند از اول جلوه ها می کنی صد هزار پس بگو جلوه هایت فروشی و چند.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Shuja Nawaz, who is the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. A native of Pakistan, he has worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst, has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna, and was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States, where he has an article, Trump Misses an Opportunity in Afghanistan. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shuja Nawaz.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be with you again.
Well, thank you, Shuja. And you've described in your article, you're describing Donald Trump's August 21 speech where he outlined his policy on Afghanistan in terms of Lewis Carroll's Alice in Wonderland, quoting from that, if you don't know where you are going, any road will take you there. So it was obviously long on bravado and bluster, but short on details. But I'd be very interested in getting the reaction in Pakistan, because he said some of the stuff that he said I thought was quite deeply insulting to Pakistan and Pakistanis, particularly when he suggested that they may not be civilized, to use the word civilization in a very, I thought, hostile way.
Yes, actually, I think a lot of people in Pakistan were expecting this kind of pronouncement from him. They had been prepared for it, but I think they were also unable to act before his speech in terms of taking actions that would nullify some of his criticisms of Pakistan. I think the most major criticism that he levied was that Pakistan continued to maintain relationships with the Afghan Taliban and also with the Haqqani network, which is operating under the umbrella of the Afghan Taliban. And Pakistan has not done anything about that other than disrupt their operations in North Waziristan. They continue to have some kind of a relationship, and they have, in fact, in the past acknowledged at official level that members of their families were in Pakistan, and they took ownership of bringing them to the peace talks, reconciliation talks in Afghanistan, on Afghanistan, in China first, and then in Murree in Pakistan. Of course, none of those talks have succeeded, which shows Pakistan's lack of leverage over those elements.
So what is the local reaction? I know you follow Pakistan's press, so which is quite vigorous at times. So what are the opinions that you're seeing and the responses?
Well, at the official level, there's been a general rebuttal of the president's speech from the Foreign Office. At the governmental level, but there will be a meeting on the 24th of August that will set the tone. I think it's next Tuesday, not the 24th, next Tuesday. There will be a meeting where they will discuss what policies Pakistan should adopt in countering President Trump's current position. The army chief met the U.S. ambassador, and I assume the ambassador was to fill him in on some of the specifics of what the U.S. Has leveled against Pakistan. And according to the Pakistani reports of that meeting, the army chief is reported to have said that Pakistan is not interested in receiving U.S. assistance, financial or otherwise. All it is demanding is that Pakistan's actions against terrorism be recognized, as well as the sacrifices made by the Pakistani military, in his words, in the fight against terrorism, because Pakistan has lost, you know, close to 75,000 people in the last 16 years. A very large number of the casualties have been in the military.
So, what is then the rest of the press, the commercial press? What are they saying?
Well, at the moment, it's all filled with anger and demands for Pakistan to take a tougher position against the United States, based on the fact that U.S. leverage, particularly financial assistance to Pakistan, has been dwindling in recent years. Despite what President Trump said about billions and billions of dollars of aid, in fact, the aid has really been dwindling rapidly. The coalition support funds, which were the cost reimbursement for Pakistan to have moved its troops into the border area, and for their operations against militants there, That cost reimbursement has also been held up, and in fact, most recently, a month ago, $350 million of that from previous years that was due to Pakistan was withheld because Secretary of Defense Mattis said he couldn't certify that Pakistan had done enough against the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqani network. So that leverage that the U.S. once had up to 2010 and maybe even up to 2013 has almost become negligible now. On the other hand, Ian, it's important to understand that with the continued presence of the U.S. Forces in Afghanistan, they will need supplies and they would need material that has to go through Pakistan, through what's known as the ground line of communication, as well as support for the ground war in Afghanistan by U.S. aircraft from the Gulf bases. They have to fly over Pakistani airspace to get to Afghanistan. This is known as the airline of communication, the ALOC. And Pakistan has never charged the United States for use of both the Glock and the ALOC. This is now an opportunity for them to talk to the United States about this. And if things really go south, and if they block these two access points, the United States will find it very difficult to prosecute the war in Afghanistan without making deals with Russia.
Well, that's pretty impossible. And what's interesting about the deal that they did have, which wasn't with Russia, but it was with Uzbekistan, was scuttled by one of the people that met with Donald Trump Jr. and Jared Kushner, along with the Russian lawyer in Trump Tower back in June of last year. That the special prosecutor is looking at. But that's in itself pretty extraordinary. In your article, you talk about what happened when Mikhail Gorbachev in 86 decided they had to pull out of Afghanistan. And much of what he said as echoes of the current situation, although we've been in Afghanistan for 16 years, Gorbachev said, we have been fighting in Afghanistan for nearly 6 years, and the approach has not changed. We will continue to fight for, and if the approach has not changed, we'll continue to fight for another 20 or 30 years. And what you're pointing out there is that the model of how Gorbachev dealt with the situation that he was in, where he engaged the local partners, I take it that's your suggestion for Trump to look at.
Indeed. And what was missing from President Trump's speech was any mention of Iran, any mention of China. He had a passing reference to Russia. He had bad words for Pakistan and good words for India. And these are two rivals in that regional space. Unfortunately, Pakistan is the immediate neighbor of Afghanistan. India is not. So as Gorbachev says in that minute of the November 13th, 1986 minute meeting of the Soviet Politburo, he ends his initial comment by saying, we must go to Pakistan. And later on, he says, we must go to India, we must go to Iran, we must go to China. You have to draw the regional players into this relationship because they have an interest in a stable Afghanistan, which is, after all, a trade hub and a hub for transit trade between India and Central Asia, between Iran and Central Asia, and between China and the Middle East. So that part was completely missing, although he had a throwaway line in there about the need for more than a military solution, that we need to have economics and politics play a role. But the economics and politics was missing from the solution set that he presented to the American people.
But do you think the fact that India and Iran have built a port and a rail and road link all the way from the Indian Ocean to Herat in Afghanistan, and that would be an option to circumvent Pakistan's ALOCs and GLOCs. But of course, it's a non-starter because there's tremendous hostility from the Trump administration towards Iran, and there's an expectation that Trump is going to tear up the nuclear agreement in less than 90 days from now, and that he's being pressured by both Israel and Saudi Arabia, who in effect want the United States to go to war against Iran at their behest. But if our foreign policy wasn't so confused, would this be a viable option for the United States?
It would be, and President Ghani has often mentioned this as a possibility because Afghanistan is landlocked, and this road would offer it an alternative to Pakistan and end his dependency on Pakistan. So that would be certainly possible, but the possibility of Iran offering its airspace for U.S. military aircraft to fly in support of ground operations in Afghanistan is minuscule. That is just not mm-hmm. something imaginable, and certainly not under the current circumstances where, as you said quite rightly, the Trump administration has been, if anything, but hostile to the Iranians. So that option is not going to be there. And for supplying via the so-called Northern Distribution Network to the troops in Afghanistan, primarily by air, the cost factor rises by something like 14 times the ground cost going through Karachi by road to Afghanistan. The other point which I made in my article is that the United States, under the Obama administration, with the involvement of Secretary Clinton, managed to help Afghanistan and Pakistan put together a transit trade agreement. And that was a very good first step, but the second step, which was going to be really critical in knitting these countries together, was to open the border between Pakistan and India for this transit trade to continue into India. I think President Trump, given his strong friendship with India and the relationship with the current Indian Prime Minister, could have used that as an opening to knit these countries together, to create dependencies amongst them so that they wouldn't see themselves in conflict, but they could all benefit from having an integrated market and a relationship that would allow them to benefit from cheap energy coming from Central Asia under the CASA 1000 program that the United States supports through the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, and other institutions. So that part has been completely missing, almost as if it didn't exist.
Well, Shujaat Nawaz, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, as always.
And again, I've been speaking with Shujaat Nawaz, who's the author of Cross Swords, Pakistan, Its Army, and the Wars Within. He's a native of Pakistan who's worked as a journalist, a television producer, and a political and strategic analyst, and has also worked for the World Health Organization and was a director at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna and was the director of the South Asia Center at the Atlantic Council of the United States, where he has an article, Trump Misses an Opportunity in Afghanistan. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. We can contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.